Investors Chronicle.
This week on the Companies and Markets Show, Belvoir is our result of the week. Mark Robinson has all the details on that. Arthur Sands joins us to help identify which companies are best set up at the moment to weather the inflationary storm. Elon Musk buys into Twitter and Buffett buys into Hewlett-Packard. All that and more. Companies and Markets Show, welcome back. 7th of April as we record about 4 p.m. In the afternoon, delighted to be joined by Arthur Sands. Welcome back, Arthur.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Newman as normal. Hello, welcome back.
Hi, John. Hi.
Hi, we got Mark Robinson.
Yes, you have.
Hi, Mark. And Julian Hoffman as well.
Yeah, hello there, John.
Hello. Good crew today. Yeah, delighted to have you all here and to talk through some of the news from this week. But before we get going, as normal, I'll just do a rundown of some of the biggest stories over the past 5 or so days. So last week we told you that private equity group Sycamore Partners had 2 takeover bids rejected by Ted Baker. This week the clothing brand has launched a formal sales process, price rallying 12% on the news of that. Packaging group Smurfit Kappa has joined the list of companies pulling out of the Russian market. Smurfit Kappa currently has 3 plants in Russia, but say it only accounts for about 1% of sales. Shell, meanwhile, have released the damages from their sale of Russian assets. They'll take a non-cash $5 billion hit, although this bottom line impact will be partly balanced out by higher oil and gas prices. John Glenn, economic secretary to the Treasury, signalled the UK government's intention to support crypto companies and pursue a dynamic regulatory landscape, that's a quote, for crypto and digital assets. Proposals outlined in the speech include the Royal Mint creating an NFT by this summer and regulations around stablecoin, that's crypto, which is pegged to fiat currency. Elon Musk has become Twitter's largest shareholder. The Tesla CEO bought almost $3 billion worth of shares, amounting to a 9.2% stake. More on this from us a bit later in the pod. Warren Buffett also buying again, this time stumping up over $4 billion for shares in Hewlett-Packard again. We'll be on top of this a little later. The markets this week, FTSE 100 up around 1% at time of recording, while a tech sell-off has seen the S&P 500 down 2.5%. Right, on to our topics. Firstly, we've got our result of the week. And Mark, we're coming to you for this. It's Belvoir. Belvoir is not the biggest fish in the property pond. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about it, what it is, and what you've made of its report.
And keep it short, Mark.
thank you. Yes, it is rather underwhelming this week. We've got a few more interesting results coming up in the next few days with ASOS and Tesco, but Belvoir, of course, is a relative minnow, as I put it in the article. But their experience over the last 12 months does cast some light on the evolving nature of the property market. The results was tagged as 25 years of unbroken profit growth. I was too lazy to go back and check out if that's true, but I can take them at their word. And it was a good set of results for the company as well. Their key metric, which is management service fees, were up by about a fifth. They run a franchise model within the real estate sector, and M&A has been a feature of this year's results as well. Belvoir provides a microcosm in relation to the housing market. The backdrop, of course, is that the government has been putting the screws on the buy-to-let sector in recent years, and that relates both to tax policy and also on the environmental front as well. And so you've got a situation now that with so many of these landlords pulling out of the market, that private rents in the UK are rising at their fastest level in 5 years. And that's at the same time as we've got a worsening cost of living crisis too. So the good news as far as landlords are concerned is that rental patterns are returning to pre-COVID COVID-19 status. And that's because the pandemic itself has loosened its grip. And while we might, we will definitely see permanent patterns in terms of things like hybrid working, demand for urban properties, which was a particular worry, has bounced back to a large degree. And it's the youth of the nation behind this as well. A lot of younger people are returning to cities, chief among them students, of course. That's important for Belvoir, but important for the industry as a whole. But it's important for that company is that a high proportion of its revenues are generated through rentals rather than sales. So its property division delivered revenues up 27% during the period. And that was aided partly by a deal to acquire a student accommodation network called Nicholas Humphreys. It meant that the company was able to double its net cash through the period, or its net cash outlay in relation to M&A. And the cash pile itself was up by a quarter as well. And long-dated debt is down too. So it's been a pretty, I wouldn't say stellar, but it's been a solid performance by the company over the year. So at the moment, the shares, they're not particularly expensive at 14 times of consensus earnings. And the prospective yield is just over 3%, 3.3%. And this is the company as well. It's got a net margin of 26% and a return equity of about 20% too. But that's not a bad entry point really for investors, but I would just sort of I would just be cautious in terms of the interest rate environment. I mean, we had the overnight announcement by the Fed that they're looking at incremental increases of 0.5% on the base rate, and no doubt the Bank of England could well follow suit there. So we can't be sure on what effect that will have on the overall property market going forward. But anyway, that's as I say, that was a decent set of figures from Belvoir.
Yeah, decent set of figures that have have landed them our result of the week, albeit as you say, in a bit of a down week. But yeah, we do have plenty of results, and including your one of Belvoir there. That's on our website and in our magazine as normal. Right, let's move on. And Arthur is here because this week our magazine features an inflation special, and Arthur's been one of our lead writers on that. Arthur, with producer price inflation rising faster than consumer price inflation, margins everywhere are being hit, though some companies are better placed than others. So I guess your article takes a look at what kind of companies at the moment are well set up to weather the inflationary storm.
Yeah, so I sort of started out by looking at producer price inflation and looking through the different sort of components of producer price inflation, which show, and then company inputs that will show how much different factors are inflating. And as all of us know, the vast majority of inflation is being driven by energy. I think the annual inflation rate for energy that companies were purchasing in February was at 57%. And then the next biggest input was chemicals, which is around 20%. So the majority of inflation has been driven by rising energy costs. So sort of traditionally, I think if you're looking to protect your portfolio from rising inflation, you want to look for companies with pricing power. So that means companies that can raise their prices without losing a lot of without losing a lot of customers. So they can raise their prices and maintain their margins. Historically, companies that have had pricing power, I should probably mention a good way to sort of measure that is basically to look at gross margins. You want companies with high gross margins, but also stable gross margins. So you don't want them to be too volatile over the last few years. And the companies that people usually like with pricing power, two big ones are Unilever and Reckitt. Unilever has loads of really famous brands. You've probably heard of like Dove, Marmite, Ben & Jerry's. And the kind of thinking is that people love those brands so much. People love Marmite so much that they don't mind if they increase the price of Marmite because they have to have it.
Or hate every, it, famously.
So they have to have it on their toast every morning. So it doesn't matter if it goes up a few pence. However, I think Reckitt's brands, Reckitt has like Durex, so that's some essential to some people and less so to others. And then there's Finish and like other cleaning products. And the idea is the brand strength so strong that they do take a while before they substitute it away for like a sort of own brand supermarket version of that. But
Arthur, I thought you were about to start to talk about the elasticity of demand for Durex.
No, I think it'd be pretty inelastic for some people and extremely elastic for others. But
I remember they used to send us a goodie bag years ago. I don't think they do that anymore.
Do you think we have to declare those goodie bags? I'm not sure. But with Unilever, sorry, back to topic. With Unilever, they've actually been somewhat struggling to... They've increased, I think it was the last quarter, they increased prices by 5%. But their operating margin dropped 10 basis points. And next year, they're forecasting it to fall between 100 and 200, I think it was 120 and 240 basis points. So even though they're increasing prices, it seems like revenue's dropping enough that their margins are falling. And which probably is because people are the cost of living crisis is so severe that people are choosing to go for like own brand, other versions of the products. So sort of the way that I then thought about tackling inflation is rather to look for companies that can pass on the rising costs is probably to look for companies that whose costs aren't really rising as much. And because this inflation is so asymmetrical, it's so tilted towards energy, my thought process that was backed up by notes from Peel Hunt and Liberum. Is that how you pronounce Liberum? Anyone help me with that? I think it's
Liberum.
Liberum. Okay,
Liberum.
Thank you, Alex. Liberum. They actually tipped the bowling companies, Hollywood Bowl and Ten Entertainment, which I actually mentioned in, sorry, it's going to be a shameless plug, my newsletter, The Squeeze, which comes out every Friday. But the reason why Hollywood Bowl and Ten Entertainment are great, I think, is A, I love bowling, so I assume everyone else loves bowling. But also, only 5% of their costs are utilities, and they're hedged through to 2024. The majority of, or 20% of their costs, which is their biggest cost base, are people. And real wages, although they went up a lot last summer, have actually been, it's negative real wage growth in November, December, and January. So if your biggest cost base is wages, and they aren't going up nearly as much as oil, which is driving most of the inflation, their cost bases are not nearly as exposed to this sort of asymmetric inflation we have at the moment. And obviously there may be concerns that if there's this cost of living crisis, no one's going to want to go bowling. Like, but it's only £8 to go bowling at Hollywood Bowl, and you get food, drinks, and bowling.
Hang on, is this a plug for Hollywood? This is totally into Hollywood Bowling.
Well, yeah, everyone should
sponsored
buy,
ad.
Everyone should buy Hollywood Bowl shares, of course.
Also, Arthur, can you do Laser Quest at Hollywood Bowl?
No, they've opened up a range of mini golf now. So, which is also pretty fun. I prefer bowling.
I would say on the bowling, the business model, you get the impression that they depreciate the shoes are probably on a 50-year timescale, don't they? And also the bowling bowls, you don't really need to replace them. That, you know, it's not like computer hardware which runs out. Its shelf life is 3 years, isn't it? These are assets which are going to stay around forever.
Yeah,
it's the perfect business. Actually.
And they've got this interesting new bit of tech as well, where the pins are on strings, so they can pull them up really quickly, which is faster than sort of the traditional like swooping away the pins and then reassembling them. So they can get through games faster. So they can get more people through.
Wow,
it's a good company. So yeah, Hollywood Bowl, Ten Entertainment, I think are good companies that will be immune to inflation. Also, actually, at the back end of last year, October, November, December, Hollywood Bowl's revenue was 38% above 2019 levels, so before the pandemic. So it seems like people are still really keen to get out there and bowl. So crux of the argument is services, which rely on people, don't have as much inflation pressure as goods, and if you've got sort of expendable income, it would be relatively cheaper to go bowling than it would be to buy a fancy new leather jacket or something, because that jacket's going to be made in some country somewhere and then shipped across the ocean. All of that is pretty energy intensive process, so there should be larger pressures on discretionary goods than discretionary services.
I saw a note from UBS this week as well, where they singled out semiconductors as one of the hard goods, which actually has a lot of pricing power. But I think it's partly because of the structure of that market, that it's dominated by players who can essentially charge what they want for some of their products. But at the same time, I think some people are also concerned that inflation could actually lead to... There is actually a limit to some of the pricing power for semiconductor suppliers, because at some point demand destruction is going to kick in a little bit. And if you compare that, for example, to pharma, I mean, that's another area where, you know, pharma companies are price setters. I mean, Julian, you know a lot more about this than I do, but in a sense, there's less elastic demand. There is a little bit less elastic, isn't it? Because you know, if you need pharmaceuticals, you've got to buy them.
Yes, that's right. So yeah, you end up, but they have to operate to reference prices, which is why they all hate the NHS so much, because the NHS, the price it pays for medicines gets copied by all other healthcare systems, because obviously we basically run a healthcare monopoly here. So there is a certain regulatory, they have a certain amount of regulatory imposition on their pricing. But fundamentally, yes, you're right. If you're ill, you don't have any other choice but to pay what they're asking for.
Yeah, I think with the point about semiconductors, I think Apple cut back on production of,
right.
And so they're going to cut back on production of, they have this cheaper iPhone, which is, they said they just had a lot less demand for the cheaper iPhone because of the cost of living was going up and there's less money to be spent on consumer electronics. So,
did I not just read there's a massive, that Mercedes-Benz have sent away 5,000 workers because of a lack of semiconductors? Was that?
Yeah, they all go there in Brazil. In the Brazilian factory, they're all been given holiday because there's no semiconductors.
Wow.
Sort of.
No semiconductors to be had.
A nice butterfly effect. You get to go sit on the beach in Copacabana.
Yeah. Makes you think, what shortage do we have to endure here at the Investors Chronicle to get a month off?
Maybe this is why Elon Musk is joining Twitter, because he sees the massive demand destruction about 3 months away for all electric vehicles, that he knows he's got more time to spend. In a very neat segue to our next item, or have I got the running order wrong?
No, you've got the running order spot on. You do. And absolutely. Well, as you say, Alex, and as I mentioned earlier, Elon Musk, 9% holder in Twitter, and he's joined the board. He's very much not a passive investor, as I believe he filed the documentation saying he would be, and that's now under investigation. Arthur, you covered this very briefly in our morning newsletter, didn't you? What's the precise details with Musk?
So I think there's two sides to this. One side, which is, you mentioned about the filing. Actually, I got all of my info from reading Matt Levine's Money Stuff newsletter, which our listeners should subscribe to if they don't already, because it's great. But I think the sort of passive, he explained that the, so he filed initially for a 13G, which is you file for that if you have no intention of actively involving yourself in the company. But then he then changed that to a 13D when it was announced that he would join the board. But then when he had filed the 13G, he was also tweeting things about, do you think that Twitter polls asking about whether Twitter upholds freedom of speech. I think 70% of people responded to the poll saying that they don't think Twitter upholds freedom of speech. So I think the point there is that he filed for a 13G, which was supposed to be a passive filing, but then while he owned all the shares, was still tweeting, asking questions about Twitter's operations, and then switched to a 13D. He was also late on the filing, so he passed through the 5% threshold for Twitter ownership at the beginning of March, and you're supposed to file 10 days after you pass that threshold, but he filed 11 days late. And then that's what the SEC are a little bit investigating, is that also all the shares he bought between the 5% mark and the 4% mark, the value of those shares then would have jumped up loads because the price of Twitter jumped 26% when they announced that he had become the chief shareholder. So they're like, potentially, I guess he could be fined for like the $127 million difference between the value of those shares when he passed the threshold and the jump in the price of Twitter when he announced that he was now the largest shareholder. But then I guess the question is, like, is having Elon Musk on your board and your largest shareholder, does that make Twitter 26% more valuable? You could probably argue no, because Elon Musk doesn't really care about how much money Twitter makes. Like, Elon Musk is worth $250 billion and his shares in Twitter are worth $2 billion. So even if his share, even if Twitter doubles in price, it's like a rounding error in Elon Musk's total valuation. So maybe it won't be good for the value of Twitter. Maybe he'll change Twitter like into some like open algorithm. I think the concern is apparently from advertisers that he will let anyone tweet anything whenever they want. And I'm sure Mark will have opinions about freedom of speech and people will be able to say whatever they want, whenever they want. But advertisers are worried that if it becomes a quote unquote cesspool, that people won't want to advertise their products on Twitter.
But, I mean, isn't it already a cesspool?
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, if nothing else, he's made it 26% more interesting, if not more valuable.
At this point, Musk and... sorry, Mark, yeah?
No, I was just saying, I may disagree with whatever you have to say, but obviously I'll defend with my life your right to say it.
Yeah, no, I think I probably agree with that. I think we might see, we might see Donald Trump back on Twitter soon, though, if Elon Musk gets his way. I also think it's about sort of the like less explicit stuff. So just sort of the way that the algorithm promotes tweets or not. I think the point that Elon Musk said before was that he wants the algorithm to be like open source, so everyone can see how it works and how it sort of ranks different tweets.
I suppose the point for investors is it's very unclear. I think as you said, it's very unclear how just 26% more value equates to, I mean, it might be 26% more noise about Twitter, which there's always so much noise about Twitter anyway, but whether, you know, how this actually translates into more value for a company or whether it is now just, yeah, the plaything of the world's richest man, which it already was, arguably. So he just has a board seat to potentially disrupt things even more. I mean, the governance questions, I suppose, aren't they, of the whole, you know, what's to come. But I don't know. I'm not seeing a really good valuation case for why this is good.
Dogecoin also jumped. What was the valuation case for Dogecoin when Donald Trump tweeted a meme about it? Elon Musk tweeted a meme about Dogecoin. And
it's just the proximity doubled of Elon Musk to any asset, isn't it?
So just trying to touch the hem of his robe.
I think personally, I would pay to see him in one-on-one combat with Vladimir Putin. he offered him out, didn't he, a couple of weeks ago? I think I remember that.
He did.
Well, Elon Musk is a bit younger, but Putin's a judo black belt, so I don't know whether one comes in your favour.
Yeah, I think I know who my money would be on. Anyway, we digress. Okay, finally for today, again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Warren Buffett is buying again. A few weeks ago, we were chatting about Berkshire Hathaway's acquisition of the insurer Allegheny. This week, he's bought $4 billion worth of shares in IT conglomerate Hewlett-Packard. Julian, what's the details here?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? It's a bit like waiting for buses. You wait for sort of Berkshire Hathaway for 6 years and then two deals come along in 2 weeks. So he's taken over the stake in Hewlett-Packard, which is everyone's favorite dysfunctional IT company, allegedly. I'm sure that we're covered if I can say that. And it seems to me that the interesting thing from an investment point of view is that it looks like it's a pure valuation thing with Buffett. I mean, Buffett is a famously purist value investor, and it looks like HP, which is a largely sprawling conglomerate, which is another investment theme with him. He seems to be buying
strange conglomerates at the moment. The HP is running sort of 9x earnings, and the sort of the reference index, the S&P 500, is running at 25x earnings at the moment. So it's a clear and interesting value play, I think, from that point of view. Whether that will play out like that is difficult to know. I mean, HP is sort of recovering, but it's had a very torrid few years. Some very odd management decisions, quite a lot of, you know, particularly the difficult acquisition of Autonomy, which has been grinding through the courts ever since 2011, really. And only this year has sort of reached something approaching a conclusion. But there, you can see that he's using value methodology to try and pick up the bounce on that company, I think. And it has, the share price has been recovering. It's sort of doubled over the last couple of years, but it's still only 9x earnings. So it kind of shows you how far they fell. But you know, if the management's up to it, then it is a recovery play, I guess. Or they could break it up. I mean, that's always the other option, that they could start selling bits of it off. It does all sorts of hardware, but it also has this kind of software as a service kind of industry space. I think the problem with HP is it always gets behind the curve on everything. So they always buy something at a very high price, just as people are about to move on to the next bit of technology. So it's never been a particularly happy company, I don't think. But that was a very interesting deal from the Sage of Omaha, I would say. But we'll see how it pans out.
We shall. Do you think there's something in the current climate, the current turmoil, that, you know, as you say, Buffett and Berkshire haven't really been making any moves for the past 6 years, and then two come along at once? Do you think they've spotted that now's a good time?
The other thing I think is interesting is, sorry to interrupt, it's the thing that's also noticeable is that he seems to be buying companies that have a very US focus. And I don't know whether that's just like a vote of confidence in the US economy. I don't know whether he feels that growth is still going to come in America, or it's just a case of saying, well, are we buying companies now that aren't reliant on long supply chains, on, you know, this kind of, it's the globalization trend retreating to the extent that we ought to be focusing, or Berkshire ought to be focusing on, you know, kind of inland kind of investments. And I think that might be an interesting theme that emerges from this. I mean, the smart money is looking at the global situation, the global economy, and deciding, okay, we don't need anyone with lots of, you know, factories in China. is something that we're going to avoid, and that, you know, we're going to be good old US of A from now on. I think that might be an emerging theme.
Well, we'll see what he buys next week, I guess. great. Well, I think we'll call it a day there, guys. Thanks for joining me. And thank you, listener, for listening to this podcast in association with Hollywood Bowl, accidentally, this episode. But yes, we'll see you at the same time next week. So we'll catch you then. Goodbye. The Companies and Markets podcast was edited and produced by me, John Rogers. And don't forget to head on over to iTunes or Spotify and hit subscribe, and we'll show up in your feed each week. See you next week.